Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Pro Lacrosse Podcast. I'm Kyle Devitt, the Gear and Lifestyle Editor for Inside Lacrosse, and today I am joined, as always, by
Chris Rosenthal, Inside Lacrosse Freelance Contributor and Pro Lacrosse Analyst.
Man, we got a lot for you guys. We're recapping week six. This week is my MLL week, so we're going to start out with what is traditionally the most important game in the MLL season. Chris, do you know why?
Because 50 million people traditionally turn out to watch it.
You're a little off on the number, but you're right in the spirit. And that
20
is... 20
million?
We'll see. That is the 4th of July game hosted annually by Denver, and that was won by the home team, Denver 14, Chesapeake 13. This was a statement win from the Outlaws, powered by who else? Zach Currier, the best all-around midfielder in the MLL, gets the game winner. A no-angle drive from X, where it looks like he's floating to the sideline and somehow gets enough power to get it past the goalkeeper, finishes with 4 goals and 1 assist. On the other side of the ball for Chesapeake, another huge Lyle game, went off for 5 goals, 1 assist, should have had 6 goals as one of his diving goals was disallowed, in my opinion, incorrectly. The story of this game is that the Bayhawks had this in the bag, but they actually collapsed for some reason. You could say the pressure of the spectacle, something like that. I'd like to think that maybe Denver just wanted a little bit more, but this was, as we mentioned before, the 4th of July game, and this is and will be the best attended pro lacrosse game of the summer. However, the attendance was a shade over 26,000, which sounds impressive until you look back and realize that that's the lowest attendance for this particular game since 2010. Chris, how worried are we about this?
So I'm not really that worried about it. I think maybe after another year or two, if it kind of hovers around this number or below, maybe then we should get worried. But I think the big thing about this one was the weather was just garbage, right?
So, oh, yeah.
You know, if you want to go sit outside, you know, it's a bad time for that. It's just constantly pouring and, you know, it had some lightning delays. And, you know, maybe you're thinking, oh, we're not even going to get fireworks. And, I mean, you know, sitting out in the rain just kind of sucks. So I can imagine a lot of people who just kind of decided to bag it and not go.
Yeah, I mean, and also, like, announced attendance is basically tickets sold, not necessarily people with butts in seats. So, and that goes across the board for any attendance that you ever read in any sport. It's not a, we're not attacking pro lacrosse here. It's just a fact that attendance numbers are always a little bit juiced. I want to talk to you about something else, though. Denver are clearly title favorites. But despite what the headlines may say, that's down to the contribution of players like Chris Aslanian, Matt Gilray, and Brendan Kavanaugh, as much as it's down to Dylan Ward, Zach Currier, and Junior. And I think, personally, the development of those lesser-known players is what makes this team so good and what has traditionally made Denver a playoff perennial favorite getting to that position and getting to the title game or at least the semifinals. I think, conversely, though, the lack of development of similarly aged or tenured players on other teams is what's making those other teams bad. What do you think Denver does better than the rest of those teams? Is it just they're drafting better guys or getting guys to buy in? Or what do you think is the secret sauce there?
I mean, I think it is largely what he just kind of got at. I think a lot of it comes down to front office moves, the ability to kind of see something in a player that, you know, other teams might not see, or, you know, maybe some other players might have been cast aside in a previous stop or something like that. And I think, you know, I think they've had some success, obviously, the past few years, kind of finding some guys who they can pencil in. And I think this just kind of carries over with, like, guys you mentioned, like Aslanian and Gilray, and, you know, particularly Kavanaugh. Even when they had him on the roster, they still kind of had to decide what to do with him. because, you know, they had him last year and he just didn't produce because, you know, there were other people in the way. But even when they had the opportunity, it's like, okay, are we going to play him at attack? And it's like, well, you know, maybe if we bump him up to midfield, we're going to get him some advantages on these matchups. I think it really helps now, especially with these, you know, younger guys joining the teams, that they have somebody like Junior who's there in, you know, his coaching role and like his, you know, sort of administrative roles in addition to his on-field stuff. He can kind of get these guys together. Like, there was a goal 2 weeks ago. He scored the goal, and then he was the first guy to the sideline with a board drawing up what everybody should be doing. And, like, I know he was the person who was kind of tasked to find, you know, some attackmen who could fill the spaces heading into this season's draft. So I think someone with his ability plus his eye, you know, especially now that he's been working with colleges, I think he knows a lot more what to expect out of players. So that sort of thing is something that I think Denver is especially good at among other teams.
A guy that I think maybe Chesapeake doesn't know what to do with, judging by the last couple games, is Colin Heacock in the middle of a big-time slump. One assist and 11 shots in two Bayhawks games. This is just one of them. What is the problem there? Because he's supposed to be the face of that team, and I think my theory is that it's just a little bit of collateral damage from Lyle and Stanwyck dominating the ball, but is there something else that you're seeing that I'm not picking up on?
No, I mean, I think that's definitely a good part of it. You know, in years past, like last year or whatever, you would have Lyle who'd be on the team for, you know, three games or something like that. And, you know, he would be incredible, but he would only be there for, you know, like a month.
Yeah.
But this year, they just set up right away. And it's like, okay, this is Lyle's team. And they're still going to have, you know, Steele running from X. But, you know, it's largely Lyle doing a lot of ball carrying. And that's certainly fine because it works, you know, a lot of the time. And I just think, yeah, you know, maybe Colin Heacock's role isn't going to be what it was last year. You know, it's also, especially last year, they could move him around. He was playing attack or midfield based on things like matchups. And I just don't think they have that kind of room to kind of bounce him around right now. It seems like a more sort of set lineup, you know. Like you bring Mariano and, you know, they had Bomberry playing as well. It just seems like it's a little more solid right now. So maybe Heacock isn't in that position where he just kind of, you know, gravitates to success. And he might kind of, you know, I mean, we'll see. Maybe he'll bounce back. But it seems like he might kind of be one of the people who, you know, fades away a little bit and the other guys do the heavy lifting.
By the time people listen to this, I'm betting that the MLL All-Stars will be released. Do you expect to see Heacock on there?
Maybe. I think so, but largely is kind of residual from last year and just being a name that people know of, which, I mean, I think that's just kind of, I think that happens in all places, but definitely is sort of a lacrosse all-star sort of thing. It's, you know, who do we recognize, and, you know, I don't think it really comes down to the points and things like that as often as one might assume, you know?
Yeah, you'd think. And we're going to get there, but we're still talking MLL. All right, the second game. Quick turnaround here. Chesapeake 16, Atlanta 13. Chesapeake gets a measure of revenge here by taking down the quote-unquote other best team in the MLL in Atlanta. Just had a strong fourth quarter. And again, another signature Lyle game. This time, 5 goals, 3 assists, which means he had 14 points in 3 days. Chris, is that a record? Probably. Can we check the reliable stats? Absolutely not.
Well, let's just go ahead and call it a record. How about that?
How about we do that? That's an IL Pro Lacrosse Podcast record.
Congratulations, Lyle.
Yes, well played. Now, I think the thing everyone wants us to talk about here is the altercation. A few of them. One of them was a hit from Warren Jeffrey earlier in the game. And then it turned into a little gloves-off knuckle duster between Bayhawks defenseman Warren Jeffrey and Blaze attackman Randy Statz. I watched it in real time. I watched it again in a highlight package. And I'm going to be honest with you guys. Pretty tame exchange in terms of, I mean, not to be like, it's not a fight unless there's damage, but none of the punches really connect, and it was a lot of glancing, kind of like rolling with the punches, blows. Do I think it was a quote-unquote big deal? No. But what it was an opportunity for the MLL to show that they are happy to discipline their players and quote-unquote set an example of how they are different from other leagues. And as part of that, what came out today, we're taping this on Monday, you're going to listen to it Wednesday. Bayhawks defenseman Warren Jeffrey issued a statement that we're going to play for you right now through the Bayhawks social media channels.
Hey, how's it going, Bayhawks country? Warren Jeffrey here. I just wanted to reach out to all our friends, family, fans to apologize on behalf of all of us here at the Bayhawks organization for some of the unsportsmanlike conduct that was presented by myself and a few of my teammates in last Saturday's game. I'm personally disappointed in my behavior and will work to set a better example for all our young fans out there. Unfortunately, as a result of this incident, I won't be able to play in next Sunday's game versus the Dallas Rattlers, but I'm eager to get back out there, get after my teammates, and continue to represent your Bayhawks the best way you can. Thanks.
All right. Two things. First thing, he has a tapestry behind him that looks like a doily from like a grandmother's house.
All right.
Why is this happening? I don't. Is there? Could you not get to Bayhawks HQ? Like, what's happening? Number two, I'm not saying he's not sincere, but he's like reading as he's saying it. Instead of like just giving an apology, which could have been like 10 seconds, but they probably made him do that. And by made him do that, I mean, it looks like someone is like holding a gun under the table and making him talk. Like, are you in trouble? Blink twice. I'm a little concerned. And I don't mean to like make fun of it because I'm sure people are really kind of worked up about it, but it happens all the time. And this is just another way of the... And the MLL, by the way, for those of you that are like kind of new or whatever or haven't watched pro lacrosse as, you know, intently as you have this summer, the MLL's history of disciplining players for altercations is awful. Like, truly, like, egregiously either way too harsh or nothing at all. And it's a total, it's just like a home run batter stepping up to the plate against an ace pitcher every time something happens. They very rarely hit the middle spot where it's just right. This, like, as far as penalty goes, that might be right here, like a suspension for like taking helmets off, ripping a helmet off, throwing punches as wild and, you know, not good as punches are. I understand. But to like have the player issue an apology is like, I don't know, man. I don't, if he did it on his own, I'd be like, cool, like, good for you. Like, you mean it. And I'm not saying he doesn't mean it, but like doing it through the social media account and like making this part of an example is weird to me. What's your take on the quote unquote fight?
So I heard about the fight first, and then, you know, later I saw the highlight from it, and it was much less severe than I assumed based on, you know, what I had heard about it. I thought there was going to be a lot more contact and serious sort of damage being done. The apology, it does feel kind of a hostage video-ish.
Yeah.
And it feels like, you know, like if two kids get in a fight and then like the parent drags one kid by his ear and is like, say you're sorry. And it's like, I'm sorry. And then, you know, they drag him back away. Like if, you know, obviously since we don't know, you know, if it's his sincerity, if he wanted to do it, or it feels like they were like, okay, you're going to go in front of this camera and you're going to tell everybody you're sorry. And, you know, you're going to say you're disappointed in your actions and blah, blah, blah. And that's fine if that's, you know, the message that the Bayhawks feel is the best way to approach this situation. It seems a little odd to me because, I mean, I just think, you know, fights happened and punishment was doled out. So, I mean, I don't think he did anything so bizarrely egregious that it, you know, that it warranted this sort of thing or that he demanded it.
He didn't try to flying ninja kick him or anything.
Right. Right. It was like a stabbing or something, like, or it wasn't like an off-field altercation or something.
Right.
But I would have just, if I'm the Bayhawks, I would have been like, listen, we want you to go and record a video. We want you to say the following things and just give him like 5 bullet points and then let him kind of fill the rest up however he wants to fill it up, you know, kind of like a like jazz or pro wrestling or something like that. Just kind of get from point to point, because it does kind of take you out of the moment when he's like, I look forward to getting back, and you see that he's reading that part. You know, he could have done that without the writing. You know, like if I just said to you, if I was like, hey, listen, Kyle, I want you to go give a presentation to these people, say you're sorry, say, you know, that you offended the children and you'll try to be better. And then you can get from point A to B to C. You know, I don't need to spell everything out for you. Yeah. Like if he didn't remember that they were playing the Rattlers, he could have just said, I won't be there next week. And we'd be fine with that. And it would look way more genuine.
Yeah. No, I agree. And also, I would never do that. But that's just me. And also, I just went through the Atlanta Blaze Twitter. I don't think Randy's going to be apologizing for anything. And if he was, it would be like, I'm sorry I didn't connect. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's how Randy would apologize. And all the power to him. It's just two different ways that guys operate and franchises operate. And Jeffrey comes from a great culture at UVM. You know, I've done a couple stories on them for IL. That's an amazing program. And again, not really to make fun of him, more of the situation here. So it's not, we're not trying to get too personal, but that video is some hostage stuff. I'm sorry. Like, it's got to be pointed out. I also do not want this to be the overlaying message of the game, that it was defined by a fight, because it actually was an incredible win for Chesapeake after, you know, a few losses that made you question their ability the last 2 weeks. I think as long as Lyle's on the field, this team has a chance to beat anyone. But for a team that prizes defense and hoards defensemen like Pokemon cards, their team defense late in games is very bad. And that needs to be addressed. I also think they're going to continue to get beat up on draws until they find a faceoff guy that can compete with other top tier guys like Woodall and Adler. And Woodall, especially in this game, was incredible. So, you know, a lot of work there to do, a lot to build on after this win. But I think, you know, we're going to move forward and talk about, oh, this one's rough. Boston 15, Dallas 11. Oh, where do I start? All right, so listen, Dallas actually came out strong here and were up for, I think, longer than they have been all season. But a two-pointer from James Fahey tied the game after a few big stops from Carson Bannister were, like, building towards a momentum for the Rattlers to go for, and it just got broken, and that was it. Cannons went on a run after deploying this, like, army of Dodgers to test the Rattlers' defense, and that Rattlers' defense failed that test. Here's the thing. I've been hard on the Rattlers. I admit that. But this game itself crystallized a larger theory that I have about the exodus of star players from the MLL to the PLL. And it's this. You can be big and fast and skilled, but if you do not have game sense or understand tempo, you will be found out at the next level. Dallas has all these young, flashy players that are great initial Dodgers. They get their hands free on anyone. But that second and third step of either making the choice to pull the ball back out or make a pass or go all in for a shot, that execution has been atrocious. And that is why they're not succeeding. Because I think that defense is getting better. I mean, Craig Chick is like maybe the best LSM in the league, possibly. I wouldn't be surprised to see him make the All-Star roster. Again, it's going to be out by the time you guys listen to this, but again, I would not be surprised if he was on there because he does have the stats to back it up. And I actually want to, while we're talking about kind of the game and the broadcast, I want to compliment LSN host Evan Washburn, as he summed up Boston during the game as a team full of B-level players. And he clarified that he meant that as a compliment. And I got to be honest, he's absolutely right. But when you have a team like that, what happens in other pro leagues? Any idea? What's your take? What do you think happens when you have, like, a team full of bees?
So, ideally, you can steal a couple wins here and there for a team full of bees. You know, like, probably not going for the championship, but, you know, your goal is probably 500-ish, you know?
Yeah, maybe make the playoffs, maybe.
Yeah.
But I think what also happens is that 90% of the time, those B-level guys are packaged and turned into an A-list guy. No one needs an A-list guy more than the Canucks. And Chris, do you know who I think needs a change of scenery that would make Boston into the contender that they believe that they are right this second? Do you know who that player is?
Who is that player?
You know who it is. Say it.
I mean, if you talk about change of scenery, maybe Rob Pinnell?
Woo! Rob Pinnell, the Boston, you heard it here first. Just kidding, they'll never do it. Pinnell's uncle has ownership stake in the Lizards. There's no way he's going to leave. And there have been two MLL trade deals with Pinnell in them that were okayed and then vetoed by a certain owner to keep Rob in New York. And one of them was to Boston, and the other one was to Florida. And I'm not going to tell you when those happened, but obviously it happened before Florida ceased to exist. So that was a part of it. Which leads us into our next game. Man, Atlanta 12, New York 11. New York, New York. Can't win a game. That being said, this was very tight throughout. But I feel like, when we talked about this before we started talking on the podcast, I feel like there's this weird thing where when a game is close that people think it's good, like the level of play is good or it was entertaining. Just because this game was tight does not mean the gameplay was good. The defense was not good. The offense was even worse. And I think there's this weird phenomenon of, like, if it's a close game, it's a good game, which I do not think is true. And this game proved that. The Lizards had 7 turnovers in the fourth quarter alone. RP3 finishes with 2 goals, 1 assist. Feels like his frustrations are bubbling over on every play. It's like he's a genius chess player that refuses to play with guys in the park because he's the champion. They should come play him. And he's not wrong. That's not a criticism. He's not wrong. I don't want to say this seemed like the kind of game where neither team wanted to win, because that's a stupid thing to say. And people that say that, like, are the same people that are like, oh, well, now that players are in the PLL, they're trying harder. Like, you sound so dumb when you say that. Like, honestly, if that's true, like, I don't know who that player is, because everyone tried their best when they were in the MLL and they're trying their best in the PLL now. So I think I hate when people say that. But the execution in this game in particular was just lacking for both squads. For Atlanta, I think you can point to the absence of Randy Stats as a big reason for their, like, kind of hollow center. But for New York, I feel like there's no excuse. What do you think the Lizards need to do to get their second win?
You know, I feel like the Lizards are still kicking around the concept of their identity. And I honestly think at a certain point, you know, they went back to this sort of thing where, okay, we're going to put Rob on the crease and we're going to play him up top. And we're going to let everybody else do what they do. And, you know, he'll be, you know, more of a contributing factor. And that's fine if you're going for like, you know, like unity and, you know, everybody getting a turn to try to be great or whatever like that.
Yeah.
But I don't understand why you don't take one game, you know, maybe they'll do this, you know, later in the year or something like that. Maybe they could do it against Atlanta, but take one game and just say, all right, listen, give it to Rob, run it until your legs fall off.
Yeah.
You are just the quarterback. Everybody else, just give it to Rob. It's like the Bel Air prep, the old Bel Air prep offensive strategy. Pass it to Will every play.
Yeah. Overload one side, maybe. I don't know. Try some off-ball picks. Figure it out. I think your first point that you're trying to make it into a more flowy offense, I think Rob is great when you do that, and the other guys in the offense are Paul Rabil, Joe Walters, and Will Manny. That's great. Still gets stopped, but still great, and definitely puts up more than 11 goals. I don't know. I don't know what they need to do. I think they just need to play like teams that will, you know, give up that X spot, and they need to have guys off ball can their shots. I think Dylan Malloy had some nice G's in this one, had a real spectacular like low to high snipe on men up that and the Lizards notoriously, by the way, awful on men up, converted a couple here. So something to look forward to, I guess, to build on, because Atlanta's really good. But again, Atlanta will be like, well, we didn't have Randy Stats. Atlanta still made a ton of mistakes in this game and played ugly lacrosse. So I'm hoping for next week both of these teams to just kind of raise up a little bit more and improve their execution and really cut down on those turnovers, because there's just so many – and there have – the problem with the MLL, and the reason it looks like slower, I think, when you switch from PLL to MLL, is that a lot of these turnovers are happening in the middle of the field. And in the PLL, there is no middle of the field. There's a line, and the faceoff guys are there, but there's no, like, distance. There's no, like, room for things to go wrong, and you don't see – I thought you would see a lot more sideline shenanigans in PLL, and those are just turning into offsides penalties for some reason. But in MLL, you have, like, every time I watch a game, this one play happens where this exact play, just on a different part of the field or a different side, doesn't matter what the teams are. A long pole will overcarry to the half line and look for a middie. And the middie he hits is the farthest middie on the sideline. And that middie catches that long pass and gets forced out of bounds within five steps. I feel like I've seen that play 50 times already. Right?
Yeah, it happens.
Yeah, you don't see that in PLL that much. Why do you think that is? Do you have a theory? I mean, I don't know. I'm just asking.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's definitely something to it. Just the restructuring of the field dimensions and that sort of thing, like you were mentioning.
That makes sense. All right, we're going to move on to the PLL weekend recap, week 6, Premier Lacrosse League. Chris, tell me all about it.
All right, we are starting with the Redwoods versus the Archers. Redwoods take this one 9-8 in overtime. They got some payback after losing by a goal to the same Archer squad back at Red Bull up in New York. It's the first PLL game where neither team managed to crack that double-digit mark. And that is stunning to think about, you know, as we were just talking about the field size being reduced, the, you know, super fast possessions and this and that. Yeah, man, 9-8, and it took extra time to get to that 9. Obviously, the big thing coming into this game was the absence of Greg Renlian, who's dealing with the hamstring injury he suffered last game. Would it make a difference? I think everybody assumed it would make a difference as far as the faceoff stats went, and it certainly did. Redwoods won three entire faceoffs out of the 21 that they took.
It's incredible.
Yeah, that's a remarkable number. Also remarkable, it didn't matter. Right. If you're looking to have the debate about the value of the Face Off right now.
No, don't do this to yourself. Don't do it.
Oh, no. I said if.
Okay. Good.
If you're looking to, because I'm not. But if you are.
Because listen, the last thing we need is a war with the Phogos. We can't have it. I already reached a detente with the Demons this week. Okay. And that was a hard negotiation. All right. I can't go to war with the Phogos. I just can't. There's not enough left in the tank. It's not happening. So we love Phogos. It was weird that one didn't play. Continue.
Sure. I mean, you don't think they're on Twitter or anything, do you?
Oh my God. They have splinter factions. They're like sleeper cells everywhere. Every time you post about a Phogo, it's like someone pops up and is like, yeah, well, he didn't go do great head to head against this guy you've never heard of. And you're like, wait, what? What'd you say to me? Okay.
Yeah. So I'm definitely not an anti-Face-Off person. I'm just saying, you know, if someone, you know what, never mind. They can, I'm not going to give them anything. I'm not going to give any anti-Face-Off people
Don't do
any
it.
Material. They can do their homework. So anyway, another thing I noticed from this game, so obviously the low scores, and you have to wonder, why is this score so low? 7 shot clock violations for the Archers.
That has to be a record. That's a record.
I really think it is. I'm looking at some of these other box scores, and it's usually something like 1 to 3, maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say like 2 to 3 is average. That's wild.
Yeah, 7 is just incredible. I don't know how that happens. Another thing that stood out, do you know the only Archers midfielder who scored a goal in this game?
I do, but only because it's written on the rundown and I watched it.
That's right. Scott Ratliff, the long stick midfielder, the only Archers midfielder to score a goal.
What?
It's bananas. It was a weird game. But a lot of it came down to, like, you know, Archers, they attack, trying to, you know, work out some feeds, and then the Redwoods defense just, you know, chopping everything down, knocking down all the passes, and that sort of situation. It was very solid close defense play by both teams and solid goalie play by both Tim Trautner and Drew Adams, who got the start instead of Adam Gittleman, who had been starting previously. Now, Ryan Boyle on the broadcast, I believe it was him, he said that Gittleman's benching was not performance-based, just more of wanting to get Drew Adams a shot. And, I mean, I guess that is reasonable if you have Drew Adams just sitting on your bench.
Yeah.
You know, might as well. Also, if you've been losing a couple games, you know, it's even more of a reason. Yeah, let's toss him out there and see if he can kind of, you know, I often question how legit it is when people say, you know, oh, well, I'll, you know, sub this guy in, give the team a spark or something like that. You know, I think that's used way more as kind of just like a verbal crush than it is an actual, you know, strategy. Like everybody should play hard all the time. But maybe there is some legitimacy to it. But I mean, they lost either way, so who knows? That being said, do you think they go back to Gittleman, or do you think it's like, well, we're pretty pleased with how Adams did, regardless of the score?
I think they were probably just scared to split time with him, and just like committed. And I think maybe it's probably better to have this duo split. I don't say that often. I think the only example of teams that had guys that split time that won a championship is, if memory serves, the Toronto Nationals, and it was Queener and Doc Schneider legit splitting time between them, right?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we've got a couple weeks for them to figure out if that's something that they're going to look into going forward, or if they're going to, you know, go one way or another. I mean, Gettleman is used to having a split, so, I mean, it is something that I don't think would totally throw him off if that is the direction they're going to go. But speaking of roster shakeups, another thing we saw from the Archers, Christian Cuccinello getting some quality minutes, playing time, kind of shared the third attack spot with Kevin Rice for a while, and it looked like later in the game he just kind of ended up staying there. I don't know if that was all strategy-wise or, you know, if Rice's availability was, you know, put into question later in the game, but it seemed like Cuccinello kind of just settled into that spot. And he ended up scoring 2 goals there. which was, you know, I mean, especially in the eight goal performance, definitely stood out as one of the most productive members. That being said, some of it was done against the short stick. The Redwoods kind of had a strategy going in where I think basically they were going to take Pat Harbison against Rice and, you know, kind of devote their, you know, we kind of talked about this last week, but they, you know, devote some of their poll resources elsewhere. And so when Rice went out, they kind of went back with that for Cuccinello. But the size disparity there, when you then have Cuccinello, who's like 210, 215, going as a short stick, it's a little bit different of a play. So it didn't work out as great for them. Overall, long story short, Archers are, you know, even if it's a one goal loss, but they are kind of spiraling right now because of how many losses they've strung together now. I mean, they're 2-4 right now, four straight losses, if I'm not mistaken. So it seems like this break couldn't come at a better time for them just to figure out what's going right and what's going wrong and how to, you know, how to kind of get back on the right foot. Did you see anything that kind of that you kind of could play off as saying, okay, here's a good thing, you know, like what do they do that going forward that helps them out?
Well, I think they, you know, they had two faceoff guys here, right? They dressed Fowler, and they, I think that they thought they were going to dominate the faceoffs, and they did. The problem is that I feel like the Redwoods kind of wanted that, because the one team that plays that slow down style that the Redwoods defense loves to play against is the Archers. So matchup wise, I people were asking me before this weekend, like, what would happen? Like, is, have you ever seen a team not dress a faceoff guy? And I'm like, well, Acello can take draws. Like, he's not terrible. They got a couple guys in that team. You know, Tyler Dunn took draws. Tyler Dunn was a nationally ranked faceoff guy before he went to Penn, you know, in high school. He was on the cover of one of our issues at Inside the Cross as a faceoff preview, like Faceoff Revolution kind of thing. So I don't think that was like crazy, but the fact they only won three kind of makes it seem crazy, but they made up for it. They're like, the Redwoods made up for it, but the Archers couldn't. And I think they sputtered at times where, you know, we've seen them be able to move the ball quickly and finish the ball. I don't think that they were comfortable enough because the Redwoods were throwing like a lot of hedges, a lot of like early slides and then holding slides. Like, you never quite knew what they were going to do. So the Archers were constantly trying new things. They ended up jamming the ball and taking long shots instead of waiting for the right pass. And the whole team is built on waiting for the right pass. And if that comes in the first 10 seconds or the last 5 seconds, that's fine. Right? I think that that's their level of patience. But the problem is, like, when you play against the Redwoods in this great 6-on-6 defense that they have, that patience is wasted. And that's what happened here. As far as the rest of their losses, I said this last week, I think they need to pair another Dodger with Schreiber. I think that needs to happen. Like, it's worked somewhat, but it hasn't translated to wins. I think they just need to find another guy. Like, I was surprised that Wes Berg went to the Redwoods in a trade. I thought he might have gone to the Archers. You know, that would have been a guy that could, you know, draw a slide, and you can't cover him with just a shorty on the wing, especially high wing. So I think maybe they just need to re-examine where they're attacking from to get more production out of the personnel that they have.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested to see how many of these players, just overall in the PLL, have played their last games with the teams they're currently on. You know, they've got this break, they've got the All-Star game. You know, I think some of these guys are not going to be going back to the same locker room that they were walking out of this weekend.
Yeah, it's possible. Trade deadline is the 22nd of July. So I think, you know, a lot of times in pro lacrosse, that trade deadline pretty much means nothing.
Sure.
But I think we, and I think it'll still mean nothing in terms of like A-list guys, but I think you're going to see a lot of B's and a lot of C's either switch or get switched out for the second half of the season.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a lot of guys who still haven't even really played at all, or, you know, maybe just one game, you know, like recognizable names. So, you know, and also a lot of these teams, if they're losing these games by a goal or two, maybe their coaches are thinking, all right, we're just one tiny contributor away, you know, one bad bounce. You know, a lot of these guys might not blow up the whole thing just yet. Let's move on to the second game here. Took place later that night, and much, much later that night, because a monsoon came rolling through that basically ruined everything. And this game started late, took forever, lightning delay, you name it. I'm talking about Whipsnakes versus Atlas, the rematch from their Hopkins battle, Terps versus Blue Jays. Whipsnakes take this one again, this one 11-9. Super weird game. It felt very herky-jerky start and stop because of all of the literal starting and stopping. It felt to me like the Whipsnakes kind of had their offensive identity very early on. And as a result, they were able to jump out to a lead. They jumped out 8-3 lead, and it felt like it basically felt like it was over when that happened. I felt like things were just going to get really out of hand at that point. But the Atlas did kind of claw their way back and, you know, make it an interesting game later on. But the Atlas, to me, felt like never really got on board with one sort of offensive strategy or game plan. You know, you can kind of sense it from other teams. It's like, oh, okay, they're trying to, you know, drive from X. They're trying to do a two-man on the side or whatever. I didn't get that from the Atlas. And so when I was thinking about it later, I was like, you know, this seems like a thing often I get from the Atlas. Still not exactly sure. I wrote this down later, but I guess I'm going to ask right now. What do you think is the Atlas? We were talking about the Archers this way last week. Like, what does the Atlas team want to be, you think, on offense? And how close are they to actually getting there?
I think they call plays for guys. And they cycle through that. I don't think they have a set team offense, like a set that they operate out of, yes, but I don't think they have a philosophy. Does that make sense? I think it's a beat your guy, see what happens philosophy. And listen, we've seen pro lacrosse teams win championships with that philosophy, and the Atlas have enough talent to do that unless they play against a defense that is ready for it and or is more talented than their offense. And I think that's what you saw here. You know, that Whipsnakes defense is unbelievable. It's so good when they're on, when they're switched on. When they switch off, they look awful. Like when they think that, and we've talked about this many times, I think the mentality of the Whipsnakes, the problem with having that much young talent on your team is like they always think the game is won. Right? And that's good. That's confidence. But, like, they have a tendency to downshift when you really need to put a foot on the neck. And I think that that's how Atlas got back in the game. But also, like, you look at how the Atlas scores goals, and they're pretty, right? Everything that the Atlas do is very pretty. It needs to be gritty. And I didn't mean for that to rhyme, but it did. I do think they just need a little more grit in terms of not committing to a dodge where you draw a double, but committing to like contact, hitting the dodge, hitting that rollback hard, that guy going hard and trying to make something happen there. I think there's a lot of one-on-one that turns into one-on-none and not getting a good angle. And then the shot happens anyway. You know what I mean? Like, I think they just dodge to poor angles and shoot a lot.
Right.
More than it, like, listen, every team in the PLL has a guy that does that, or like three guys that do that. I think it's more apparent with the Atlas because of the caliber of the guys that they have dodging. You know, McCardle, Tinney, Rabel, like Eric Law cutting off ball and putting away secondary chances, all that stuff. I think that you look at that and you go, it looks so good. What's the problem? And the problem is that when the dodge doesn't work, there's no exit. Like, there has to be an exit or a rollback. Like, Atlas would really benefit from, like, a deuces set where the high guy goes and only dodges to see what happens and who comes, and then either rolls back to hit the other guy to dodge immediately and he looks for a pass, or brings it down and works it back through X and you play big little back there. Like, I don't see them doing that, and I don't know why. Because they have the perfect personnel to play big little or low wing or high wing dodges, and they use Tinny really great in that way with the high wing dodge. We saw that last week and a little bit this week. But I think what they need to do is get the ball moving and also use the dodge to advance the ball to a place where they can kick it to another spot for an open shot. And you just don't see that. You know, that they're a one pass team, one pass go. There's no 2, 3, 4, 5 passes unless it's broken. When the play's broken, that's when they look at their best. But they have all these guys that love to carry the ball and not enough guys that don't care about carrying the ball, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know what should be done with it, but I feel like too much pretty, not enough gritty should be something.
I think that's a Atlas fan account on Twitter. That's what I think.
It might already exist.
Wait, hold on. Let me make it. All right, good. We're good. Got it.
Perfect. I will follow as soon as I get off of this podcast. You kind of mentioned the Whipsnakes defense, and I think a lot of ways the Whipsnakes have been especially successful. One of the things that consistently impresses me when I watch these games is how quickly the close defense hops on defensive rebounds. Because Brimlore will give up a bunch of rebounds on these shots, but his guys around him just snag them instantly, and there's no second chances with them. And but personally, I think this was Brimlore's best game as far as clean saves go. Usually I'm keen to kind of keeping track, you know, seeing who's doing, you know, the most work. Like, is it Bryce Young? It's Matt Dunn down there. Who's doing the most cleaning it up? But it really wasn't an issue in this game because for whatever reason, I don't know if it had, you know, if the weather had something to do with it, or maybe he was just on, you know, maybe his pocket was a little more absorbent or something like that. But, you know, the shots, he was just eating them up and just not giving up any second chances, which is another reason why I think the Whipsnakes, you know, hung on to that big lead they had. That being said, I think Jack and Cannon had a great game as well. For the Atlas, a lot of clean saves for him. One time he gave up a little rebound and got in some trouble, but he kind of had some split-second reaction thinking, and while there was a scrum running towards the ball, he just kind of swept it away. You know, like you'd see like a hockey goalie knocking it to the corner. Just very smart plays. I thought it was a great weekend for PLL goalies all around.
Yeah.
Every team was represented by very strong goalie play. Face-offs. Joe Nardella had 2 goals in this one. Didn't win as many faceoffs as Baptiste. But that didn't matter. I think he was very productive with the ones that he did have. And also, I felt like the Atlas weren't necessarily making the most of the wins that Baptiste was having.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a short field sort of situation, but I've seen a lot of teams kind of get hampered by this. You know, because Trevor Baptiste wins the faceoff, one pass, and you're like, hey, all right, I'm almost by the goal, let me shoot this. And it's like, all right, but you know, if you're going and you're shooting it, and there was one particular play, I'm gonna say Kyle Hartzell, because I thought Kyle Hartzell had a pretty solid game otherwise, had a nice goal, you know, big face dodge, really good play all in all. But there's a play, Baptiste wins the draw, you know, which basically, you know, snap, it's right over Hartzell. Hartzell's like, all right, I'm pulling up, stick side high to Brimlore. And then it's like, well, you know, it goes down as a win for Baptiste, but it's pretty much just nothing because, you know, one pass and you're already back at midfield. So I feel like there's a very, very distinct difference between winning a faceoff and getting a possession or doing something with a possession.
Yeah, there should be a stat for that. There's no stat for that.
It's a major disparity.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that they didn't really do Baptiste justice with a lot of his face-off wins in that regard. Atlas are now 2-4, but what kind of sticks out even more than that is the minus 12 point differential. You know, it doesn't seem that crazy. I mean, if you're going to play 6 games, you know, you're going to lose 4 of them. Yeah, you know, okay, minus 12. But the closest team after the Atlas is the Archers with a minus 2 point differential. which seems insane. He could be 2-4 with a -2 point differential, but that's just kind of where we are in this league. So, you know, Atlas are another team. They'll kind of regroup during this break and figure out where to go from here. It seems like the past couple of weeks they went away from what I thought was really sort of successful, where they were keeping all four of these attackmen on the field at all times. It seems like it worked, but then it doesn't seem to be the strategy that they decided to really put the foot on the gas for. Maybe they just felt like, you know, other guys had better matchups this weekend. So it seems like they've gotten away from that. As far as the people they do have on the roster, though, you don't have to go power rankings or whatever, but does some of this just come down to, are they maybe the fifth best team right now?
I mean, yes, in a way. But I think that also that goal differential is unkind because of what happens in the next game we're going to talk about. And that differential was not as – there's another team with what should be a worse one, but somehow isn't because of this win. And we've seen teams, you know, in the PLL look like they're beat and come back to make it close or come back to win a lot of the time, more so than I would say anyone expected. And one team we haven't seen do that is the Atlas, and that's why they're 2-4. I don't know if that's because they have trouble putting together runs, but I do think that they have trouble capitalizing on all of their possessions. And they do, not more so than other teams, but it's more noticeable, I think, because of the names that are on their squad. They are prone to wasting possessions, like with early bad angle shots. That is just how they play. And some teams get away with that. And one of them got their butt whooped this weekend because they got away with it too much. And I think that's kind of one of the things that separates teams in the PLL is can you your 50-50s and not 50-50 ground balls, 50-50 shots. Like, I don't think this is going in, but I'm going to shoot it anyway. And I think the Atlas are not great at that. And again, it goes back to them taking kind of low angle, low percentage shots that just flat out don't drop. And honestly, a lot of that in this game in particular has to do with Burnmore, because if you took a poll of all, maybe not all PLL players, but PLL players that played in the MLL against Burnmore, I guarantee you Burnmore would be the guy they don't want to shoot on. Like, if they were one-on-one with someone, he's the last guy. He's the first guy they would be like, I don't want him to be the goalie. That, like, he's very respected amongst the pros as one of the best shot stoppers in the world. And for some reason isn't with the quote-unquote crooked media like us. Except that he is, because I say it every podcast. But it's okay. People don't always listen to these. I understand. So I got to write more about Kyle Bornlaar is the end of this rant that I'm having right now.
Sounds good to me. I think we should put together a team of players. It doesn't have to be position-based, but let's get a team of players together. And I don't know, maybe we'll call it like Shut Up About Them or something like that. And we will officially kick them out of the underrated conversation.
Yeah, it's like team what about, but team shut up about.
Yes.
I like it.
Yes.
I like
it. Just be like, look, we can't keep calling X player, Y player, and Z player underrated if we're talking about them.
Every podcast.
Right. Right. If we're saying nice things about them, then, you know, maybe they're not being underrated. So yeah, Kyle Bornlaar is a monster, like you were saying, in one-on-one situations. You know, I mean, people going all the way back from, you know, the college, like the big saves in the championship game on Kluche, you know, like that sort of mashup. He's just done nothing but ever since. He's an absolute monster one-on-one. He is probably the only goalie who, like, top of my head, if you were like, all right, got any attackman versus him on a one-on-one, what do you think? I'd be like, yeah, maybe I'm going goalie on this one. You know, because it should be so easy to score in a one-on-one situation like that. But, I mean, he's just outstanding at it. That being said, let's tackle this last game here. One of the I guess it's probably not as highly anticipated. I'm guessing maybe some people thought it might have gone differently, but it certainly went one way, and that is the Chrome, no longer winless, Chrome 19, Chaos 11. What a way to shake things up right before this break. Those winless Cellar Dwelling Fellows over Chrome, knocking off the top team in the league at the time, and doing so in a convincing fashion. Not only knocking off Chaos, but dropping them to third place in the standings, because that's just how close things are right now. This game started off close early, like the teams traded goals, but then Chrome went up 3-2, and at that point they never tied or trailed again. And part of that came down to them scoring in bunches. Like, they're scoring 3 goals, then finally Chaos answers, but then Chrome scores 4 more. And they just maintained that pace the entire game. A lot of personnel things to kind of bring up in this game. You know, Chaos made a bunch of moves. They dropped Matt Reese to close. They bumped Brody Merrill up to long stick. Miles Thompson was out with an elbow injury. They put Mike Bocklet in his place. They put Jeremy Thompson in the midfield. Brett Queener started the game over John Galloway, but then he left in the second quarter when Josh Byrne, I was going to say it was a dive, but basically he was cutting towards the goal, and Queener saw it and jumped out to kind of, you know, initiate contact on him, you know, go for a hit. But Byrne kind of fell on him, and I think, like, his knee brace did something to Queener's leg, some sort of stinger in the leg situation. So then he's out. Galloway comes in starting the second quarter. 7 saves for Galloway. I thought he played pretty well there. His first save was against Josh Byrne, which who had kind of been Queener's kryptonite going back to the previous matchup.
Yep.
In that regard, it worked out really well. Galloway with new Adidas pants, I believe.
Three stripes. Saw those three stripes, him running out. I was like, oh, wow, all right.
Yeah, full three stripes. He used to be an Under Armour guy with tape over the UA. And
you're not allowed to say that on the podcast, I don't think.
Oh, this was a long time ago.
Yeah. I think technically he was an STX guy for a while. I think he still is, which technically makes him a Nike guy, kind of, depending on how that relationship goes. But yeah, no, he wore sweatpants, logo taped up. Yes, I do recall that.
And now it is stripes over checks. He is a. I don't know what I can say about his pants. But anyway, new pants for John Galloway. That being said, it was a beating, man. It was a serious beating. Chaos issue, I think, defensively. I think they were a mess. They had a lot of things that they would want to clean up defensively, like ball-watching issues, backdoor cuts.
Yeah.
There was one play where they had 2 guys covering Justin Gutterding at X. I don't think that's a good idea. It's traditionally not a smart play to have a double team behind the goal.
Yeah.
But the thing was, not only were they making the mistakes, but then, of course, you have to have a team that can take advantage of the mistakes. And, you know, in some games past, I don't think Chrome would have done that, but they definitely did this game. And conversely, Chrome defense was very solid. I thought Joel White had a really good game. The whole sort of the Chaos midfield that was largely silenced. Miles Jones, no points. Deemer Class, no points. Dane Smith, no points in there as well. Just a lot of, 19 goals, that's the new PLL record. And, you know, I'm not sure anybody expected, if you said, all right, Chaos and Chrome are going to square up, one of the teams is going to score 19 goals.
You know, I don't think anyone's saying Chrome. I don't think anybody is. Right.
I think the money was probably on Chaos, but
yeah,
you know, it just goes to show you, there's potential in all of these rosters. And I think, you know, the Chrome had some things that went very well for them. You know, a couple things that hadn't been working that great in the past, like, Jordan Wolf, obviously talented, you know, we've seen him
obviously being picked on by everyone for not having good enough numbers when you've got plenty of other stars that are underachieving. Somehow Jordan Wolf is the punching bag. Yes, please go on.
So, I mean, I'm certain he wasn't pleased with how he'd been playing prior to this game. Before the game, he was shooting 7 of 37, 18%. But his shots started falling. I think he was initiating from, you know, he would, like, catch a pass and then work his way upfield a little bit more. I think he kind of got away from the dodge from X and shoot as soon as you get to goal line extended. Because in the past weeks, he had gotten to goal line extended and shot, but it wasn't falling. It wasn't going on goal like it used to, you know. So I think he kind of got away from that, got more into, you know, inside rolls, you know, things that kind of increased his angle and paid off big. I think this is his best game, 4 goals, 2 assists, and paired with the last time they played last week. Either he's shaking off whatever's kind of bothering him earlier in the season, or, you know, he's just really good against chaos. But either way, you know, he'll take it. Like I said, 19-11 final. What did you think from this one? Were you obviously, I think it seems too easy to say, were you surprised? But
oh, of course.
Did anything in particular surprise you?
So have you seen the movie Reign of Fire?
I don't think so. Is it about dragons?
Yes. Yes.
Nope.
Okay.
I know that, but I have not seen
it. All right, cool. Well, you need to see it because it's a preposterously hilarious and awesome movie at the same time. So many plot holes. But kind of the point of that movie is, like, it's post-apocalyptic. Dragons are real. They burned everything down. And now people are, like, out in the countryside living in old castles because old castles are the only thing the dragons can't burn. And also the dragons eat ash, which makes no sense to the rest of the plot. But I wanted to put it out there. The one point I want to take away, using it as an analogy for this game, is that one of the characters is played by Matthew McConaughey, and he's an American soldier in England. He's got a bunch of tanks and kind of like planes and other aerial devices to like trap the dragons and kill them. And his whole philosophy of doing it, because dragons are impossible to kill, is you do it at twilight or dawn. Because that's when the dragon's sight is compromised by the change from light to dark. Mm-hmm. And that's called the magic hour. And I feel like the chrome hit the chaos dragon in the magic hour and just took advantage of every single little thing that the chaos did wrong. And by that, I mean the chaos are a team that thrive off of loose balls, turning into passes, turning into goals, and fast breaks, and broken plays, and mismatches. And the Chrome did not give them any of those things, and the Chaos had to play straight up 6-on-6, and they looked terrible because of that. And I think that now that teams are going to watch this game and go, wait, we just can't try to play like them. We have to play more like other teams and not let them get easy goals and not slide early and hold our spots and kind of, you know, push Fields out and make him work more. I think that some of the lineup changes definitely hurt them. I think moving – they double-pulled a lot on the face and really paid for it on the other end because they committed 2 pulls up for that as a resource, and they got caught out so many times. And I don't want to pick on any single one guy, but like certain guys just were getting exposed by one-on-one guys by the Chrome. And the slides from Chaos, especially against Wolf, who was a monster, were either late and bad or non-existent. And again, we've said on this podcast, you can't play him like that. And you can't play the Chrome like that. Because the Chrome would just pull out a shorty and go. And once they started rolling, they were pulling out poles and be like, come get me. Now you're dusted. You know, the Dodgers on the Chrome had a day. It was a monumental, like historical day for dodging for the Chrome. Like they killed it. They played their best game, bar none. And the Chaos flat out played their worst game. And we see 8 goals here. And I was actually waiting for something like this to happen for a while because we've seen this in MLL. Many, many times where there's just enough film where you can go, okay, they run a lot of stuff through him. They like to shoot from here. And there's enough data now, 5-6 weeks in, that these coaches can now game plan better for their matchups and kind of predict what the other teams are going to do. And now we get into the kind of spycraft of how do you predict, how do you counteract, how do you do those things? And I think one of the teams that is already doing that, and the proof is this weekend, is the Redwoods. And now if the Chrome can kind of adjust now and kind of listen, they got the ball rolling and they just ran after the boulder going down the hill at some point, especially the fourth quarter. Like, the game was over. That thing was over in the fourth, and they just kept going. And that's what you need to do in the PLL. That's what you need to do in pro lacrosse to win all your games. Because there's a shot clock and there's a two-point line. And no one cares about your feelings or where you went to school or what team you're on. They are there to score on you. And if you get embarrassed, so much the better. And that's what we saw here. We saw the Chrome just kick the Chaos's tail like they've never been kicked before. And I think that that's going to open up a lot of things. I think the Chaos, not that they got by on their name, but like people were prepared and then they were like, no, we'll slow it down. No. And then they get caught up in trying to catch up. And the Chrome never did that. And that allowed them to win this game huge and win their first PLL game. So congrats to them.
Yeah, I definitely think it was kind of a situation where like the smaller guy figures out how to beat the bully that's beating everybody else.
Yeah.
Took advantage of that situation. You know, we've seen in the past, and I remember we were talking about when the Archers played Chaos, it was like, okay, let's go into this and, you know, set up our own tempo and we're going to do it. And then as soon as the game started, it was like, ah, and they just tried fighting.
Yeah, exactly.
Just didn't work. But the Chrome situation seemed completely different. They were like, okay, we're going to set this tone. We're going to set this tempo. We're going to throw some wrinkles and, you know, we're going to dictate how this goes. And the chaos, you know, they caught the Chaos, caught them napping for one reason or another, or a combination of a bunch. And yeah, they took advantage. And yeah, very solid game for them. I do have to say this, speaking of not caring about your feelings, they pulled the ball out and killed the clock at the end of the game. And I was disappointed by that because, you know, not just because they could have gotten to 20 maybe, and that would have been, and you know, they already had, you know, the current record or whatever, so, but that would have been one thing. But with, especially if you have one win, who knows what the point differential is going to be, is going to mean going forward. You know, like if you don't have the wins that are going to say get you to the next level or get you into postseason contention, you're going to have to take advantage. Like if you're beating a team, you're going to have to just kick their teeth in, right? Because it come down to, you know, you've got four wins or something and, you know, somebody else has four wins, but they have a better differential than you. So I was surprised that they did that. You know, I guess sportsmanship was what it came down to.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you can afford to do that when you're getting your first win this late in the season.
I think that's because Dom's the coach. I'm not kidding. I'm not.
Yeah,
and no shots. Like, I think that's like because he's the classy dude. Like, that's the old school mentality. Like, you don't do that. And they didn't do it. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right in that they probably should have. Just from the basis of how the tiebreakers are going to work and how close this league is and how it's kind of playing out to not look like there is a really dominant team, but there's teams that are figuring themselves out so much faster than other teams. And now when you're playing catch up, you really need to take it to everyone you can, which, you know, you could say missed opportunity or you could say good sportsmanship. I don't know. I think sportsmanship matters a little less than the pros because you're getting paid to play lacrosse. Like, play it to the 100th percentile of your ability. I don't know. I don't think I would have been mad if they went for it, obviously, but I'm sure like lacrosse purists would be like, I can't believe they went for it. But I'm sorry. I promised before the podcast I wouldn't do voices. I did a voice. I'm sorry. I apologize to Chris and Chris only. But yeah, I think that's what you're dealing with, but I think you're right. They should have gone for something.
Yep. Oh, well, next time, I suppose.
There's always next time to beat a team by eight. All right. We have a big question this week. and that involves the PLO All-Star rosters. Chris, do you want to pose your questions involving the All-Star rosters?
Yeah, so I'm going to bring up my rosters here, but I'm going to throw this over to you. Checking out the rosters, was there anything you particularly liked about it? Like, did somebody make the team that you thought was like, oh, hey, good call? Conversely, is there anything you thought they screwed up about? Big question, final. Do you care, or do you more sit back and say, okay, whatever, it's an All-Star game, you know, it's not bad either way? Like, do your feelings come into play when you're looking at the All-Star roster?
So my thoughts on All-Star are, I love to see, that my favorite thing is to see the guy that has worked his tail off and improved so much to be at the top of his kind of position. And maybe that position isn't celebrated, like a defensive midfielder or a faceoff guy, for example. Or even a second LSM or something, just like finally blossoms, becomes the team's first LSM, and now they're an All-Star. I think we got that with the D-mids. I don't think we got it with the faceoff guys. And I think that a lot of guys are on here because of who they are and not their stats. And if you want to at me on that, feel free, because you're wrong. That makes me care. Not that I care less. It makes me kind of go, well, what's the point then? I mean, I'm pumped that Mark Lessini's in the game, man. That dude does thankless work. Absolutely thankless work. Like, I'm excited for him to be in. Am I excited for anyone else? I don't know why the whole Chaos team is in there. The whole Chaos attack. And there's like 10 whip snakes. All right. I mean, a lot of it is popularity and not, but there's something to be said for that. There's something to be said for the fan input. And I'm not saying don't have it. I just think there should be some sort of like combination of things. And with MLL, like, I basically got lied to about how the MLL rosters were constructed for like 10 years. So I can't even tell you what they're actually going to do over there. But historically, at least the PLL was like transparent about it. Like, this is a fan vote and we're going to have the players pick the teams. I'm like, okay, at least I know what I'm getting. So I wasn't surprised, but I was a little disappointed that there weren't more Mark Lessinis. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I think what it comes down to, as far as the, you know, fan vote, as far as the construction of the guys we got on the team, is, so this is a pro lacrosse league that is 6 games old. And so I think what it comes down to for a lot of people, any sort of casual PLL fan, is you take the guys you've heard of before, and you take the guys who have done something cool, like this year that kind of caught fire or something like that. And that's essentially the roster. You know what I mean? Like, you say, okay, this guy's numbers aren't quite what, you know, like player X's numbers aren't what player Y's numbers are, but I remember him from, you know, last year or whatever, or I know him because of this. And I don't think there's inherently something wrong with that, but I think that that is, in fact, what it is. And so, you know, 10 years down the road, if somebody's going to the Hall of Fame and they're like, oh, this guy's a 5-time All-Star, then you kind of have to wonder, what does it mean to be an All-Star? If you're putting it on a resume as a merit, as like an accomplishment-based merit, I feel like it's not necessarily that. It doesn't necessarily hold up under that weight. A lot of it just, I think, comes down to, oh, I think that guy's cool. You know, for a lot of people, I assume it has to come down like that. You know, not a lot of research conducted. I'm personally not really mad at any of it. There are some guys who, like, you know, I had jotted down thinking, like, oh, you know, hey, maybe this guy should be there. Maybe this guy should be there. You know, like when I was filling out, you know, my votes, I was like, man, you know, John Rannigan is murdering everybody.
Yeah.
I think he probably deserves to be there. He wasn't. He was not there, I don't think. So, you know, I mean, I think it happens. I am not one to get really worked up on it, because I think essentially what All-Star games come down to is you know, there's two schools of thought. You can look at it like, who is doing well enough to earn a spot? Or you can also look at it like, oh, who do I think would be really cool to see playing on a team with some other guys? And, you know, I think especially with the fan vote, and, you know, you don't give criteria as to how you make the determination. So, you know, you get a combination of both. And I think, you know, some guys kind of get left to the side in that regard. But I think that's just kind of nature of the beast.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like an advertisement for PLL, but every game's like an all-star game anyway. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. The pace, the not the lack of defense, but the abundance of broken plays, I'll say, is so high in a regular PLL game that, like, I don't know what this is going to be. So I'm kind of interested in seeing what the all-star game's going to be with all these players. I do want to see that. And listen, I mean, everybody does the captain pick a guy kind of thing. Like, I get it. I have no problems with that. I have no qualms at all. I think that's, you know, modern. That's what they're going to do. And listen, if PLL is anything, straight up modern. Is that trending? Put a hashtag on it. Let's go. Like, that's who they are. That's great. That's fine. That's how you grow things, is by embracing, you know, social media and technology to make your efforts, you know, double, triple, quintuple in size and even more than that. So I have no problem with that either. Again, it's a lot of hemming and hawing. I had a friend of mine text me and he's like, your votes are crap for All-Star. And I'm like, all right, man, cool. Like, what should I have done? He was mad that I voted for Dren over Rambo, but I'm like, did you read it? I'm like, I talked about Rambo. It was a tiebreaker for me. Like, Drenner was so clutch. Like, I got to reward that. I only got 3 votes. And he's just like, yeah, but you know, you're just being contrarian. And I'm just like, okay, man. Okay. Whatever you say. You know, like, whatever you do, whatever vote you're going to cast, you're going to get some sort of aspersion from somebody. Somebody's going to come after you. And at this point, I kind of expect it. But at the same time, like, seeing all these guys on here, no one's undeserving, especially if you consider body of work, which, let's face it, there's some body of work and name in the streets kind of selections here. And you know what? You get like 5 of those. And I think there's 5. And I don't think I need to name it off because I'm not in the business of naming that. I'm not a dry snitcher. That's not what I do. So I'm just kind of looking at it and go, all right, I guess that makes sense. I do wish like Brett Adams was in there. Dude's amazing. Dude is one of the best stories in the whole league. Hasn't played since 2016. Shattered his ankle. Multiple injuries after that. Muscular injuries. Comes all the way back and is the difference in several games for the Redwoods. So I would have loved to see him. But other than that, I don't think we can talk about snubs because the rule goes, put a guy in, take a guy out. So I don't know. It's fine. It's not the worst, and I think that I'll probably have more qualms with the MLL one, weirdly enough, when that comes out. And if you're listening to this, again, it's probably already out. But I did votes for that, too, and I don't know. I think my votes for that were probably less controversial because I think it's easier to pick top guys in the MLL than it is in PLL, just by virtue of the talent disparity, which is real. I'm sorry. Like, it's going to upset people, but there's just way more proven talented players in the PLL and the MLL right now. So,
yeah, and I think you know, Brett Adams, I think just needs a little more PR work. I think, honestly, to tell you the truth, like, you know, he might have lost out to some other people based just on, you know, is his name carrying the weight it deserves to? And, you know, I don't know how things, I don't know how the machine is run over there, but you know, yeah, maybe maybe next year he'll have some videos or something like that. Yeah. And, you know, people know the name a little bit more.
You know, Chris, I blame myself. I should have written a Brent Adams article already. It's my fault.
It's not your fault.
I mean, you know, I'll take it. And Brent, if you're listening, you know, I'll help you out on social. Hit me up. Low cost. We're good. Does that break journalism rules? No. I feel like there are no rules anymore, so it doesn't matter. So
no, there are no journalism rules.
Yeah, there's zero rules. Yeah.
No.
Come on. We know you're all stealing anyway from us. All right, so let's go to our recommendation of the week. I'm going to go first. A little update from last week. Still marathoning DS9, but slowed down significantly due to the impact of Stranger Things Season 3, which, no spoilers, is good. I have one complaint. It's a little too on the nose with some of the references, but small quibble. Not really my recommendation, though. Like, I'm sure you're already watching that. So, in the vein of Chris's Oreo recommendation and different flavors of said celebrated cookie, my recommendation of the week is a Target exclusive. And it's Buffalo Ranch Trail Mix. It's exactly what you think it is and more. It's amazing. And it pairs perfectly with a marathon of Stranger Things, season 1, 2, or 3, to improve your summer streaming and also hit that flavor profile. I love it. I love it. I have like 4 bags of it in my cupboard right now. Check it out. Only available at Target. It's one of those Archer Farms custom Target trail mix things. So wherever aisle that is, wherever Target there is near you, go check that out. Chris, what's yours?
So mine is a book. I discovered that this book was free on my Kindle Unlimited membership or whatever. So if you have Amazon Prime, you know, they just give you a bunch of books and movies and stuff. So if you're in that boat, then, you know, it's free and you might as well check it out because it doesn't cost any additional money. It's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. It is old. It's from the 70s from a gentleman named D. Brown. But it is a historical and very, very detailed recollection of basically the relationship between the Native American people and those coming from the east to the west, you know, establishing their lands and stuff like that. Basically, how I'm reading it is every chapter is about something different. So I've been reading it for like 2 months, just like read a chapter at lunch from time to time. And, you know, like I said, since everyone's different, it's just tiny little stories and you can just, you know, read one and then put it down for a week or two or whatever and then go on to the next one. But I think it's pretty relevant, especially, you know, you hear a lot about, you know, we've heard a lot about, you know, historical things, historical discussions. You know, we had the incident in Philadelphia during the box season that kind of sparked, you know, another discussion about just the way that people treat people they don't understand or don't know about, or, you know, the history of, you know, lacrosse culture and its indigenous people. So I thought it was really sort of an educational approach to it. If you are like me and you, you know, went to school and learned literally nothing about the topic, I think the book is a really cool way to learn some stuff that we should, you know, all probably know way more about than we are taught. So that's my recommendation for the week.
Chris, I can't tell you how excited I am to do a podcast with someone that reads. It's been a rough year for co-hosts on podcasts that don't read books. I'm going to be real with you. So I will definitely check this out. I think I've read something else by this author, and it's not the D. Brown that won the slam dunk contest in like 1991. It's a different D.
Brown. It is not.
Okay.
That would be remarkable.
That would be amazing.
Different guy, though.
I'm really all in on that. I choose to think that it is. But just for in my own mind, in my own reality. All right, that's going to do it for our Week 6 Inside Lacrosse Pro Lacrosse podcast. Thanks for listening. If you liked it, make sure to leave a review on iTunes or wherever else you're listening to this podcast. Chris, where can people find you on the social medias?
At ChrisRosie22 on Twitter. Check me out there.
And you can find me at TheKyleDevitt on Twitter. And that's it. Thanks for listening. See you later. We on bike. Step up in the party. Step up in the party. Ride up to the party. Ride up to the party.